91, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Andrew Smith tells us about new findings on how human brains are affected by time in outer space. Dan Novak presents this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Andrew Smith.
A new study has found that areas of the brain containing fluid expand when astronauts are on space missions for 6 months or longer. The American space agency NASA funded the study. The brain areas are called cerebral ventricles. They contain cerebrospinal fluid, a clear and watery liquid that flows in and around the brain and spinal cord. The fluid helps protect the brain against sudden impact. The fluid also removes waste products. Researchers based their research on brain scans of 30 astronauts. They found that it took 3 years for the ventricles to fully return to normal size after long space missions. The results mean that astronauts may need to wait at least 3 years between longer space missions. Heather McGregor is a University of Florida brain scientist. She was the lead writer of the study, which appeared in the publication Scientific Reports. She told the Reuters news agency that if the ventricles do not have enough time to get back to normal size, they could have less space to expand on a following trip to space. This could affect the brain's ability to deal with the changes in gravity that astronauts face. Rachel Seidler is a University of Florida professor of applied physiology and kinesiology. She was also a writer of the study. She said, "The impact of ventricular expansion is currently not known, and that scientists need to do more studies on the subject." She added that the expansion likely compresses the area of the brain around the spaces. To compress means to press, squeeze, or make smaller. On Earth, valves in the body's vascular system prevent fluid from staying at our feet due to gravity. But in space, without gravity, the valves push the fluid more towards the head. Seidler said this is what likely causes the ventricular expansion. As a result, the brain sits higher in the skull. The study involved 23 male and 7 female astronauts from the U.S., Canadian, and European space agencies. The average age of the astronauts was 47. 8 of the astronauts traveled on space shuttle missions that lasted about 2 weeks. 18 were on International Space Station, or ISS, missions of about 6 months. The other 4 took part in ISS missions that lasted about a year. The astronauts who went on short missions experienced little or no ventricular size change. A size increase occurred in astronauts after missions of 6 months or longer. There was no difference in those who went on missions for 6 months compared to those who went on year-long missions. The fact that enlargement did not worsen after 6 months could be good news for future Mars missions. Astronauts may spend 2 years in microgravity during trips to Mars. The study results are also good news for people thinking about going on short space tourism flights, Seidler added. Low gravity causes other changes in the human body as well. These include decreases in bone and muscle mass, some changes to the heart and lung system, and issues with the balance system in the inner ear. Longer space missions might also increase cancer risk because of greater exposure to solar radiation. I'm Andrew Smith.
Russian forces have destroyed or damaged thousands of schools since invading Ukraine. But the harms to the country's education system go far beyond damaged buildings. Experts say schooling is suffering in extreme ways, even for those who fled the country. One example is 9-year-old Milana Menenko. She now lives in Poland after fleeing the war in Ukraine with her mother in March 2022. A Russian missile struck the family home on the second day of the war. Milana's school was also destroyed. Now, Milana attends a public school in Poland. Her mother helps her follow lessons in the evening to keep up with schooling back home. There is no time and no money for anything else. Government officials say Russian forces have destroyed 262 educational buildings and damaged another 3,019. But even for those who have fled to other countries, schooling is suffering in unprecedented ways. Families, educators, and experts say that for refugees, the effects of war and moving to a new place make studying in a new country even harder. Officials in Ukraine have said they have attempted to keep education a priority in the country. They say the young generation of Ukrainians will need to be well educated to help rebuild the country after the war. Ukraine's government says at least 500 children have been killed in the war. Thousands more have been sent to Russia without permission. About 1.5 million refugees live in Poland, the most of any country. Many chose it because it is close to Ukraine and they plan to go back home someday. In Poland, children are not required to attend local schools, but school is required in Germany and some other countries. The United Nations Children's Organization, UNICEF, estimates fewer than half of child refugees in Poland attend schools. That is about 180,000 students. Many do not speak Polish. about 30% of children from Ukraine studying in Polish school systems are also studying Ukrainian lessons online, UNICEF says. The numbers drop with older students, with just 22% of Ukrainian teens in Poland attending the country's schools. Students following lessons in two languages have more difficulties in school. This is in addition to problems students have dealing with the move to another country and the trauma of war. Many refugee families have moved several times within Poland. Students trying to keep up with Ukrainian schoolwork abroad can still experience the effects of war at home. Polina Plokenko is a 16-year-old who left her Polish high school to work on online lessons with her Ukrainian school on the front line in Kherson. Bombs often send her teachers fleeing into shelters. "It is hard because it is my last year of school, and I needed to learn a lot of information by myself," Polina said. Since age 11, she has wanted to study acting at a Kyiv university. This month, Polina is taking Ukraine's final state examination, which students must pass to enter universities. It is being given in 47 cities in 30 countries, said Marina Demyanchuk. She is a professor who helped organize the exam at a center in Warsaw. To prepare, Polina attends Saturday classes at one of three Ukrainian schools set up in Poland by the group Unbreakable Ukraine. Victoria Knapp is the group's founder. She said the school's teachers, who are also refugees, think the overall level of student knowledge is quite low. But the group's goal is to provide a high-quality education, even with a very limited budget. Some Ukrainian students are becoming better at speaking Polish and plan to attend universities there. Others still feel disconnected from Poland. Some refugees have been bullied. Milana's mother, Oksana, said she looks forward to the day when her family can return home, so that my child can go to her teacher and hug her. She added, "That's what she dreams of." I'm Dan Novak.
That was Dan Novak with this week's Education Report. Dan is on leave from work this week, but I have Anna Mateo joining me to talk more about the story. Anna and others at VOA Learning English are working on an online summer camp for some high school students in Ukraine later this summer. Hi, Anna. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Ashley. It's great to be here.
Anna, I'm wondering what you thought of this week's education report.
I found this article to be very informative and helpful, especially the part about students preparing to take college entrance exams. Now I know to research if and to what degree English will be involved in those exams.
I know that the summer camp is described as a catch-up camp for these students. The areas of focus are English, math, and Ukrainian. Can you tell us what your role is in this effort and what you are currently doing to prepare?
Currently, I'm creating some online English language classes for Ukrainian teenagers. they will be attending a summer camp in the Carpathian Mountains. But they are from an area of Ukraine that has been very hard hit during the war.
What are your goals or objectives?
My objective is to help them catch up their English levels as much as I can, and also to provide motivation to learn. If I can help them prepare in any way for those entrance exams, I'd like to do that.
Well, I look forward to hearing how it goes for the students once it's done. Thanks again for joining me on today's program.
You're welcome, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993. During his 8 years as president, he appointed more women and minorities to the government than any president before him. He also appointed the second woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Bill Clinton had a Congress controlled by members of his own party, the Democrats. Still, he failed in his efforts to pass legislation to reform the nation's health care system. During the presidential campaign, Bill Clinton had promised to help millions of Americans get health care coverage.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented health care professionals, our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. We must make this our most urgent priority. Giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there.
He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to lead a committee to develop the plan. Critics argued that the plan would lead to socialized medicine. In the end, lawmakers decided that the plan would cost too much and would be too difficult to administer. But President Clinton found support on other issues, including crime-fighting legislation. The measure included money for hiring more police officers and building more prisons. Congress also passed his budgets for 1993 and 94 that reduced federal spending. But Clinton's relations with Congress became more difficult after the 1994 congressional elections. The fight over health care and other issues had only led to greater dissatisfaction with Washington. The elections were a big defeat for the Democrats in Congress.
The rising tide lifts all boats, so they say, and the Republicans are sailing right to victory in the House of Representatives. CNN estimating that the Republicans will take more than enough seats to take control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. And here's what's interesting. It is cutting across all regions. It is cutting across all ages. It is cutting across literally all the candidates.
CNN reporter Frank Sesno. Voters gave Republicans control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. President Clinton supported welfare reform to reduce spending on public assistance, but he blocked Republican efforts to cut what he believed was too much money from programs including health care for retirees and the poor. Budget fights with the Republican-led Congress resulted in two shutdowns of government operations.
The government is partially shutting down because Congress has failed to pass the straightforward legislation necessary to keep the government running without imposing sharp hikes in Medicare premiums and deep cuts in education and the environment. It is particularly unfortunate that the Republican Congress has brought us to this juncture because, after all, we share a central goal, balancing the federal budget. We must lift the burden of debt that threatens the future of our children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values.
The economy had suffered a recession during the previous administration of George H.W. Bush. After Bill Clinton became president, the economy grew slowly at first, but then recovered more quickly. 1 month into his presidency, Bill Clinton had to deal with a terrorist attack against the United States.
There's been an explosion deep below the 110-story towers of the World Trade Center in New York City.
On February 26, 1993, members of Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center in New York City. The terrorists left a truck loaded with explosives in an underground parking garage.
By early afternoon, Lower Manhattan looked like a war zone. Office workers, faces blackened with smoke and soot, hundreds gasping for breath, staggered into the frigid February air.
The attack killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. The government later captured those responsible for the bombing. On April 19, 1995, terrorists again struck the United States. Only this time, it was a case of homegrown terrorism. The target was the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
It was an explosion blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The bombing killed 168 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack ever on American soil up to that time. The man behind the attack was Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier who hated the government. He was captured soon after the explosion. McVeigh was tried and in 2001 executed for his crimes. A friend of his, another military veteran, was also involved in the plot and was sent to prison. President Clinton also had to deal with foreign and humanitarian crises.
A year ago, we all watched with horror as Somali children and their families lay dying by the tens of thousands, dying the slow, agonizing death of starvation. A starvation brought on not only by drought, but also by the anarchy that then prevailed in that country.
President Bush had sent American troops to Somalia in 1992 to assist the United Nations in feeding starving Somalis. Civil war was preventing the people from receiving aid during a drought. In October of 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. It happened during a failed raid on a hotel to search for a militia leader.
This past weekend, we all reacted with anger and horror as an armed Somali gang desecrated the bodies of our American soldiers and displayed a captured American pilot, all of them soldiers who were taking part in an international effort to end the starvation of the Somali people themselves. These tragic events raise hard questions about our effort in Somalia. Why are we still there? What are we trying to accomplish? How did a humanitarian mission turn violent? And when will our people come home? These questions deserve straight answers. Let's start by remembering why our troops went into Somalia in the first place. We went because only the United States could help stop one of the great human tragedies of this time. A third of a million people had died of starvation and disease. Twice that many more were at risk of dying.
Meanwhile, tons of relief supplies piled up in the capital of Mogadishu because a small number of Somalis stopped food from reaching their own countrymen. Our troops created a secure environment so that food and medicine could get through. We saved close to 1 million lives. And throughout most of Somalia, life began returning to normal. Nearly a million Somalis still depend completely on relief supplies, but at least the starvation is gone. And none of this would have happened without American leadership and America's troops. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do their job right.
But members of Congress demanded a withdrawal. A few days after the battle, President Clinton ordered American troops to leave Somalia within 6 months. In 1994, President Clinton sent troops to Haiti to return that country's first democratically elected leader to office. Military officers had overthrown President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 3 years earlier. That crisis led thousands of Haitian refugees to try to flee to the United States by boat. In 1995, American diplomatic efforts, as well as NATO airstrikes, helped produce a peace agreement to end the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia. President Clinton sent American peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic. In November of 1993, Congress approved NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement ended most import taxes between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered barriers to the flow of goods, services, and investments. President Bush had signed the agreement with Mexico and Canada. American labor unions and environmental groups opposed NAFTA, but Congress approved it, and President Clinton signed it into law. Personal issues from Bill Clinton's past in Arkansas became part of his future as President of the United States. In the late 1970s, he and Hillary Clinton had invested in a land development company in Arkansas called Whitewater. Others involved with Whitewater were in legal trouble by the time Bill Clinton, a former governor of Arkansas, became president. A former judge who owned a savings and loan bank accused Clinton of pressuring him to make illegal loans to help the company. Clinton denied that. And there were questions and accusations about Hillary Clinton from the years when she worked as a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas. In January of 1994, after a year as president, Bill Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent investigator. The Attorney General named a Republican, Robert Fisk, to look into the activities of the Clintons. But critics accused him of being too friendly to the administration. In August, three federal judges replaced him with another Republican lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Public opinion was divided about the situation. Some people thought the president and his wife were corrupt. Others thought any accusations of wrongdoing were nothing more than political attacks. Bill Clinton went on to win a second term in the elections in November of 1996. But new issues about his personal behavior would lead Republicans to try to remove him from office.
And that's our program for today.
Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.